This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 30th of August 2014 on Monocle 24.
Cooking classes and fashion courses, surprises for the subscriber, and events for the adventurous. Stepping off the editorial floor, magazines that engage with readers far beyond a digital experience. All that today on The Stack, your all-inclusive, free, almost interactive guide to the print industry. This week, we take stock of how magazines, established glossies, and fresh independents or otherwise can engage their audiences beyond providing web content. We'll also look at what is the most buoyant commercial sector in the industry, the over 40s market, or should we call this a market of its own? And what's the offering? We speak to a wise industry friend who will give us the latest from an international bastion of magazine publishing. Plus, we'll meet some editors in Barcelona that like to stay at home and open up.
I think people want more, something more about the home, home-cooked food. The idea of sharing things, I think, is becoming more part of a designer way of life, in a way.
All that and much more besides today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to Studio 2 here at Midori House for this 105th edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. This week, we're joined by what you might call a magazine hack extraordinaire, a man who has shaped and transformed his own industry during the course of his career. Ian Birch spent years in New York relaunching TV Guide and working for Hearst US. Previously, he launched and relaunched Red, Heat, Closer, Grazia. Ian is currently Director of Editorial Development and Special Projects at Hearst Magazines. And he sits not too far from Midori House, just in the heart of Soho. And I guess an ever-expanding empire, certainly on this side of the Atlantic as well, because you seems like you always take an extra building in Soho, don't you, right now?
Well, there are two buildings, and we're about to get another building, because Good Housekeeping is developing this new institute, which is in St. Anne's Court.
Right.
Which
we're going to talk about in detail right. later. So I want you to give that away.
Okay. Right.
But the, you know, in terms of expansion as well, there is something about it, Ian, right? When you're in this world, and particularly where print is so much of the core still, it's nice to have an expansion story. It's sort of a good symbol, even though some people may not want to go into the third building because, you know, you want to be maybe sort of, you know, closer to the core and the center of power. It's always a positive story when you can talk about expansion.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's fantastically exciting that. And I think it's also a good time because I think print, I'm talking very general here, has finally got to grips with what the digital universe is.
Right.
And I think as a result of that, they're really beginning to kind of create proper strategies that actually start to generate some extra money.
Mm. Do you think all companies are moving at the same speed? So when you look across town or you look back across the Atlantic, do you have the sense that everyone is sort of 80% there in figuring out? Or do you speak more specifically about you feel that Hearst, at least, has part of the formula?
I mean, I think at Hearst we're doing quite a lot, but I do think that the traditional big media companies, the Hearst, the IPCs, the Bowers, the Condé Nast and so on, have a far better understanding of what the landscape is and, more importantly, where the landscape is going. Now, are we all at the same place doing as well? No, we're not. But have we all taken on board that we're changing the whole business model? Mm. And I think, you know, without saying too dramatic, we're creating kind of a new business model that hasn't existed since, frankly, the late 50s.
Right.
So that's a kind of massive change because until the last few years, we were still very much seeing everything through the eyes of magazines or print publishing. And now that's changing. We're seeing it through the eyes of, first of all, the brand, but then secondly, more importantly, the audience.
Sure.
So if it's about the audience, then what do they want? Mm. Where do they want it? How do they want it? Et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And that's a very big change from saying, who's the audience for Vogue, as opposed to who are the readers of Vogue? And I do think that's genuinely happening now across the veteran companies. Mm. And I think they're beginning to actually catch up and understand it and also realize what the assets they have.
Right.
Because I think they felt a bit kind of, oh God, we're a bit obsolete here. We're a bit last century.
Right.
You know? But I think now they're beginning to realize that they have this extraordinary emotional connection with an audience. And that's something that digital, I talk very broadly, really wants to understand and get control of. Because, you know, we hear repeatedly that Google change their algorithms all the time in the hope that they will reward original and real content as opposed to just clickbait, whatever.
Yeah.
And in order to do that original content, you have to have an authenticity as well as a sort of knowledge and authority. But more than ever, it's about authenticity. And you know this. I mean, the best magazines are the most authentic. The best magazines were always the ones with the most passionate communities.
Yes.
So they trusted you. Mm-hmm. So whether it was Smash Hits talking about Duran Duran, and boy, do I know that audience.
And and we should add, you know, in a very positive way, because it takes us to the rest of the program.
Absolutely.
You know that era as well. And I think Duran Duran is probably a good reference point. We should probably throw it a song almost if we could. I want to go back to you referenced sort of the late 50s and I think of early 60s as well in terms of a time of change. What did you mean by that? Because I've sort of got my own view about what happened then. But you know, what do you see?
I think what it is that it was when magazines were the most important vehicle for expressing a new popular culture that was emerging. That new popular culture was based around a very simple business plan. It was sales and advertising. So if you got sales and you did get sales because it was the vibrant, hot, dynamic, contemporary vehicle, particularly for that post-war generation, both here and in the US. You know, here is just as important, I think, as the US, but, you know, for different reasons.
Sure.
So it was a reasonably simple business plan. If I get advertising, that's great. I'm also selling on the newsstand. Also, people went to the newsstand in a way that they do not do nowadays. So where you bought a magazine was where you also bought other things that were important, whether it was stamps or stationery or confectionery or whatever. So it was a reasonably straightforward business model connected to a sense of real excitement and discovery, and that this was a vehicle for both a community and news, a sense of communication with an emerging kind of post-war generation or series of generations. And it's extraordinary that it lasted that long, because it's like a sort of pop song, whatever. You're always surprised that it still is around kind of decades later, because it tapped into something. So for that very reason, because it's so much part of the bedrock, this ludicrous thing that print will go away and be replaced by something else, I just think is beyond fatuous kind of thing.
So if we think about that being a golden era, are we really looking at a new golden era, or at least a new opportunity? It's the children of that generation, you and me, because it, obviously our parents were, you know, probably of a time that, yeah, there is a number of the titles that we were just referencing a moment ago. That's what was on the coffee table, the bedside table, etc. We're now looking at an audience, you know, definitely sort of, you know, 40 plus, might be 50 plus, that a lot of publishers really want to talk to. And of course, everyone sort of, you know, you were part of, you know, a different era of publishing as well, where you were about chasing sort of the fountain of youth. That was such a big part of you know, mid-80s publishing in London, I think probably in many ways. That, you know, it was the US actually looked to the UK in terms of what happened. But now we're in a moment right now where it seems that... you know, there's the generation of individuals who have the spending power. These are the people that are, of course, that advertisers, they do fight for the opening spreads and the outside back covers. So is this a bit of a second, you know, it is the offspring of that generation as well that's maybe sort of paving a new path, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do think there's a potential golden opportunity, but I think we have to be very careful about how we nurture that and bring it out. I mean, there's a really stark kind of economic argument here. And basically, this is very stark. People over 40 are willing to pay for things. People under 40 are not willing to pay for things because they're used to getting things for free. So that's actually a very good place to start.
Yes.
In terms of you can sell them things in different ways and they are quite comfortable. And in fact, they like to pay for stuff. They won't try and take music, you know, quote unquote, illegally, they are happy to buy it and so on. So I think we can never underestimate that simple fact.
And
that's
do you think
a really
that,
important fact. Yeah,
do you think that's, when you talked about, you know, the rest of the big competitive sets, or the Condé Nast and the Bowers and referencing all those people earlier, that everyone roughly has that message. So we're going to see, you know, let's say, you know, the way that you brought Town and Country to this side of the Atlantic, that is not an under 20s play, or it's not even something for their mid 20s. No. This is probably someone who even knows the magazine originally from the States, that and now it sort of, you know, certainly has relevance on this side of the Atlantic. So, and if I look at the advertising, you know, that's probably, I would imagine, Hearst saying, we wanted to bring that title over here. And, you know, I'm sure the rumblings I've heard from other publishers, it definitely seems like they are thinking about that territory, whether if it's north of 40 or it's north of 35, whatever it is. Yeah. But
I mean, 40 is a very just
sure.
It's a bit simplistic. No, I completely agree. I think there are two opportunities here and what you're talking about, again, broadly. One is, if you like, under 40, because there's so much dynamic activity around the niche publishing market. You know this better than me. It's unbelievable how many new magazines are coming out on zero budgets, but just these incredible, small, passionate communities. Mm. Now, that's a fabulous thing, because that's the start of a habit. That's the start of a real sense of celebration around print, and that's a wonderful thing. And then there is the over 40. So, A, they grew up on it, they enjoy it, they have an emotional connection with it. And also, what we're seeing too, particularly in the last 6 months from some of our research, that print is sort of A, returning, and B, in a new kind of way, that it's seen more and more as an escape from what I call screen stress.
Yeah.
Remember also, the other fact here is the biggest growing sector in the multi-platform universe is the over 40s, because they're buying all this stuff. They have no digital fear anymore. Mm. So they're quite happy to zoom between all their different platforms. And that, in result, is making print a more luxury, feel-good escape from screen stress. Mm. So it becomes, in a way, to go full circle to what you said, you know, back in the 50s, you have a copy of Life or Vogue on the coffee table. You know, it's the Mad Men set, isn't it? It's completely straight on Mad Men. I think that's going to come back in a significant way.
Absolutely. And you're just referencing about also then the surge with the sort of the under 40s market, all of the new titles that are coming out. We're going to go away for a short break. But when we come back, we're going to be looking at a magazine that's right in front of us here. Open House. We'll be heading to Spain to talk about that. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tyler Burley, and our guest today, Ian Birch. We're back in a moment.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now, or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Hello and welcome back to The Stack with me, Tyler Burley, and my special guest today, Ian Birch of Hearst Magazines. It's time for a visit to lovely Barcelona, home to an equally lovely magazine that recently landed on our desks here at Midori House. The inaugural issue of the biannual publication came out just in time for the summer break, and its creators, English interior designer Andrew Trotter and Spanish photographer Mary Louise Vidal, have dedicated their entire magazine to the idea of home sharing, throwing a spotlight on people around the world who open up their homes in one shape or form. The editorial duo also host open events inside their own apartment, something which they call the Open House Project. So what better person to send their way than our resident gatecrasher Madrid correspondent Liam Aldis. Liam went a-knocking and filed this report from the Catalan capital.
Hello, it's me, it's Liam.
Hi, Liam, come on up. That's
it? Yep, got it.
I'm heading upstairs to visit the home of Andrew Trotter and Mariluz Vidal. Many months ago, they began opening up their house to strangers, exhibiting photography and hosting the occasional dinner party. However, after converting their private home into a public space, they soon realised that they weren't the only ones. People from around the world were also flinging open their doors, and the phenomenon interested them so much that they decided to create a magazine about it.
At the beginning, just was to do this showing of my project, and that's it. This was the idea.
But when we first moved here properly,
And we started thinking more about doing the project. I had a shop at the time called Open House, and we said, look, but this is really an open house. Let's do it properly. You know, it feels in a way like a gallery. We've got 4 meter high ceilings. It's all white walls.
We have a space.
We have a space.
It's beautiful mosaic floors.
Yes.
And everything. Let's do it properly.
So you closed your shop, Open House, and opened up your house?
Yes.
Basically. the shop was like a testing ground.
And then from there, obviously, you've moved now to the magazine, which is called Open House. Why did you then want to explore this idea further on the printed page?
The more things that we did here, the more people told us about other things that were going on. And the more we got to know about other things, we thought, okay, there's a lot going on around the world. Let's try and think about putting it into paper.
The sharing culture is a big topic at the moment in Barcelona with the crackdown on Airbnb and the big protests for car sharing, all those kinds of things. It's kind of interesting that your magazine explains this concept, but from the bottom up, right from the epicenter of the home, that people are sharing their houses.
I think people are now wanting to change a little bit. I think people want more, something more about the home, home-cooked food.
And organic.
Yeah, organic. Grow your own, do things like that. So the idea of sharing things, I think, is becoming more part of a designer way of life in a way. And then sharing your home is even further, because it's your personal space and you can give something to the people and people can give something to you.
Looking through the magazine as well, there's homes in Berlin, in Milan, in Japan, here in Barcelona. Have you noticed common themes?
No, I think it's very different around the world. I mean, the common theme is that people want to share because they've got something that they want to share, or they want to do something a little bit different. But it's quite different. You know, in London, Tony makes a proper restaurant in his home for 50 people, 3 nights a week, for 1 month at a time. And he does it like 3 months each year. In Japan, it's a studio where he does special little events.
Every place is
very different.
For example, we do so many different things. So we do maybe one event a month.
One thing I'm kind of curious to ask is how you share your house to a lot of people. A lot of people come through here. How does that gel with the neighbours?
We're very lucky in this building. We don't have many neighbours. There's one pension, a centre of waxing, and a health centre downstairs.
Oh, so at night time you can do whatever you want.
Our parties are like a home party. We have about 50 to 60 people coming at a time, but they're quite well ordered. You know, we have music and we have sushi, of course, for the people to eat and everything like this. But usually by 1 or 2, it's over. So now we're in the kitchen, and this is, during the sushi parties at least, is one of the main places, because it's where Nobu is here making the food. And one of the nice things is when the people come, they can actually stand half in the kitchen and watch him making the sushi and talk to him and talk to us and be a part of what's going on.
And take your plate. Normally the people can come and take the plate of sushi and take...
Another thing that I've noticed is after each article with the person talking about sharing their space, there's then a mini guide to that particular city of where the person shares their favourite spaces as well.
The nice thing about the magazine is that the whole magazine can be act as a guide. Each article is about a person who, not all the time, but opens their space. So if you're going to London, you can go see if Tony is doing a dinner and you can go. But if he's not doing a dinner or anything, also there's a guide to his places that he likes to go. And always, when you go to cities, if you know somebody in a city, you ask them, you know, where do you like to go to eat? For instance, Mira in Berlin, she has a little cafe that she likes. She has a noodle house that she loves to go, a small gallery that she likes to go. But also, you know, the big places like the Nuri National Gallery that was designed by Mies van der Rohe.
The other thing that caught my eye as well is that each person you interview, it's a bilingual interview. You always also publish it in their native language.
It was very important for us because at first we were thinking, do we just make it in English like most magazines, you know, because we wanted the magazine to be international. And the other was, do we make it in English and Spanish? But why only in Spanish? You know, and then all the places are in different countries. So we put it in always in English, but always with the language of the interviewee.
I think he's really is more interested that the people can communicate in his own language.
We always try to make everything as personal as possible.
And that was our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, reporting on the new title, Open House, out of Barcelona. It's going to be a biannual. And Ian, just listening to that, and you're talking about this, you know, we don't really want to call it a divide, but sort of, you know, the under 40s and the over 40s. Now, this is certainly, you know, a product of, as you're saying, it's self-published venture and under 40s markets, you know, they're very much talking about the sharing economy right now. When you look at something like that, I mean, I think for all of us, it's just encouraging to see a great original idea. I'm sort of curious, do you get excited when you see, you know, any number of new titles, and are you FedExing them over to New York or saying, guys, you need to go down to Casa News and pick these up because we need to be paying attention to this? I'm wondering how big publishers observe these type of titles, which, you know, doesn't quite disrupt the market, but they certainly sort of make us think twice about development budgets and things.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think, if I'm being totally honest, I don't think we are as attentive to them as we should be. And I think that's something we need to change. And I think we will change that because, A, there's so many. I mean that positively, not negatively. And also the quality is so good.
Yeah.
And also they're so clever at producing such good content on so little money.
Yes.
Which is just astonishing. I mean, it's their business nice. I tip my hat, you know. Because...
And then we should, yeah, certainly sort of say that this is a title which is on, you know, really wonderful uncoated stock. It has a very thick cover, outstanding photography. I think unlike a lot of, let's say, self-published ventures right now, there's a little sparkle of advertising in it. And it's just a great idea.
Completely. And I couldn't agree with you more. It's such a handsome, well-crafted, lovingly put together product. I'm very impressed. And also, I guess the commercial side of me. So I was interested when you said it was a biannual. It seems to me there's a whole area of commercial opportunity there.
For sure.
So it is everything from, yes, the zeitgeist is absolutely about sharing, and that's perfect. But there's a whole area of commercial opportunity around, I don't know, everything from venues to rent or visit, rentals, guidebooks, even recipe books.
For sure.
I mean, you could create a whole ecosystem. Yeah. Awful word, I'm sorry. But you could create a whole kind of landscape around that.
Absolutely.
Targeted at a specific group. And also you'd probably find a lot more. And again, I agree, it's awful these false divisions between under and over 40. But a lot of older people would be very interested in that just as much as a lot of younger people. Because the whole Airbnb sensibility is just hotels should be worried.
You know? No, for sure. Now, at the top of the program, you were mentioning a third building, something almost of what will be an open house as well. What you guys are up to with Good Housekeeping. I mean, this is, everyone knows, it's a venerable title. It has its own life on this side of the Atlantic as much as it does in the market where it originated in the US as well. But just tell us quickly, what are the plans now?
I'm sorry, this isn't meant to be a party political broadcast, but it's exciting because GH, Good Housekeeping, is a 92-year-old brand. So that's kind of interesting. And it seems to have had this new lease of life, partly because the market, as I was saying earlier, over 40, is becoming more dynamic again. So the sales of GH, fantastically, it's now become the number one lifestyle seller in the UK, and it's beaten out Glamour, which has been there for the last 10 years. So I'm sorry if this sounds like crowing, it's not meant to.
But that's right, I'll tell Jonathan Newhouse to tune in, he can never listen.
So, but I just think it's interesting because it says something about the zeitgeist, it says something about this audience, and it also says something about a 92-year-old brand that can actually come up with a whole new way of reinventing itself. So it's moving from publication to an event. There is this new building which is all about an experience, an event. So it's cookery classes, it's events, it's so on and so forth. It's all broadcastable. All broadcast stuff has been built
and
in.
And this is something which is rolling. It's not like you're saying this. You're taking this building, there's going to be editorial staff in there, and then maybe, you know, once every few months they open up their doors.
No. As of in a matter of weeks, it will be opened, and already there are bookings up until Christmas. So it could be anything from, here's a big retailer showing us their wares for next spring, or here are people who are signing on to do masterclasses, you know. The UK public don't seem to be able to get enough of food and chefs and so on and so forth. So obviously that's a perfect place. But it's more about the kind of fascinating thing that this 92-year-old brand can be doing this kind of thing. Mm. And it's also, I mean, touch wood, it works, you know. It's also that where you can take the... This, it's kind of what I was trying to say earlier. There is this level of trust and authority that GH has. Mm. And it's taking it into a new kind of experience. Because I think more and more that slightly older audience want the experience.
Yeah. Just before we go, tell me, is this something that's been already tried in the US? Sounds like it hasn't.
We are the lab, and we're increasingly becoming the lab. And that's, I think, also exciting, because I think a lot of the big legacy companies are seeing Britain again as the kind of creative lab for stuff that they can then, if it works, spread the love across the universe,
right.
You know, obviously via New York first. But that's also an exciting thing, because you're given more freedom to be able to do that again. So in some ways, when you reference the late 50s, 60s, there is a sense that perhaps I'm being romantic, but I'm a hopeless old romantic in that way.
For sure.
There is a sense that London is becoming a lab again for all the stuff, which is not unusual to London, because it always is. Every couple of years, it's reinvented.
Ian Birch, hopefully you'll invite us down when all of this happens.
Totally, yes.
No, because it would be great to see it when
you must come.
Yes, when it goes live. That brings us to the end of edition 105 of The Stack with me, Tyler Berlay. Special thanks to our guest Ian Birch, our producer today, David Pleasant, as always, and our studio manager, almost as always as well, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time when we'll be broadcasting The Stack from Paris. That's also part of our current book tour that we're doing, The Monocle Guide to Good Business, which is just out. We'll be in Paris. We're going to be in Berlin. We'll also be in Antwerp as well. So if you want to come along, then do drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And of course, you can always listen to these programs again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, for me, Tyler Berlay, till next time, goodbye.